From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this week, we ponder the current state of artificial intelligence and its potential to, you know, elevate or annihilate humanity. Why has Google gobbled up the greatest minds in the field of robotics? Why does the Army use smartbot recruiters? Why are we leery of thinking machines but leap at the chance to snooze in the back seat while our cars drive themselves? It's a surprisingly old question, though the ancients seemed less conflicted. Take 11th century China, where mechanical humanoids chime the hours on an astronomical clock. Ever after and across the world, we craft automata to play music, write letters, and lately, even plumb our souls. The first use of the word robot, derived from the Slavic word for work, dates from 1920, a play by the Czech writer Karel Čapek. It's called Rossum's Universal Robots, or RUR, and it doesn't end well for us. Here's a scene from Yuri Rozovsky's radio play.
It was a crime to make robots.
No, Alquist, I don't regret that even today.
Not even today?
Not even today, the last day of civilization. Was it a crime to shatter the servitude of labor, the dreadful and humiliating labor that man had to undergo? Work was too hard. Life was too hard. And to overcome that...
was not what the two Rossums had in mind.
It's what I had in mind.
How well you succeeded! How well we all succeeded! For profit! For progress! We have destroyed mankind.
That mortal conflict has since played out countless times in novels and on screens large and small. I mean, it's not always a conflict, but usually, J.P. Tillot, the author of Replications, a robotic history of the science fiction film, says that this template of ambivalence was set with the film Forbidden Planet, specifically in the introduction of Robbie the Robot in 1956, a crucial year for smart machines.
Robbie, in fact, from the start of that film, is always presented as a figure that might or might not be under total control.
Robbie was a 7-foot servant and protector with a vacuum tube for a head, a washing machine tub for a body, and articulated arms and legs. Humans land on Robbie's world, which is devastated by technology. They decide to demolish the planet, but they can't leave without Robbie's technological know-how, so they take him along. Tricky. He saves them. He could destroy humanity. But he doesn't. In fact, he has a great TV career, appearing on Hazel, The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, The Addams Family, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and in his signature role,
Danger, Will Robinson, danger,
on Lost in Space. Robbie was both iconic and a bit of an anomaly, because J.P. Tillot sees a trajectory in our view of robots from pre-war fondness to post-war dread. The bomb drove home our suicidal inventiveness, and the internet, the intrusive power of great, inexplicable forces in our lives. Now, robots no longer looked like Maytags. They looked like us, as in the 1973 movie Westworld.
We will soon be landing at the ultimate resort, where you can live out your every fantasy. Each resort is maintained by reliable computer technology and peopled by lifelike robot men and women. Desire ends in satisfaction, and all in a controlled environment.
Except when that notion of control goes a bit haywire, and Yul Brynner, for example, in Westworld starts killing the other guests.
Culturally, we've always been in a bit of a muddle. We love them. But do they love us back? Here's an early scene from the reboot of Battlestar Galactica.
Deep down, you've always known there was something different about me. It flatters your ego to believe that alone among all the billions of people of the 12 colonies, you were chosen for my mission.
Your mission? What mission?
You knew I wanted access to the defense mainframe.
What exactly are you saying?
Humanity's children are returning home today.
They seduce us every bit as much as they scare us. We yearn not just for the leisure they promise, but the immortality they represent. Is that why we build them?
Yeah, it may be the natural question. Why is natural reproduction not good enough for us? Well, that's because we are not good enough for us, right? We die. We can't help but wonder if there's some possible way of postponing it. You know, just much like the replicants do in the movie Blade Runner. We want more life.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears.
More than zombies, werewolves, more even than vampires, robots in their infinite variety reflect all our greatest hopes and our greatest fears. And unlike those mythical creatures, robots exist, but not how we imagine. And they also pose a potential threat, but also not how we imagine. Up next, artificial intelligence in the real world. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Artificial intelligence is a contentious field. To the people who own it, the engineers, it's about creating systems that can adjust their behavior based on data gleaned from past experience or new information. Systems that can establish sub-goals for themselves to meet the broader goals of their designers. Machines that, in their word, think. But philosophers and others object, saying that to call that thinking is to imply that the complex web of sensations and culture that guide our thoughts can be reduced to code, and that our minds are merely computers made of meat. Engineers respond with a shrug, a yawn, and the observation that the proof is in the processing. Jerry Kaplan is an engineer, an entrepreneur, and a fellow at the Center for Legal Informatics at Stanford University. He says that the attitude of engineers hasn't changed since the day the term artificial intelligence was coined.
It was held in the summer of 1956. It was a beautiful, lazy summer, and it was a conference that was organized by John McCarthy, who named the field artificial intelligence at that conference. There were three other organizers. One was Marvin Minsky, who at the time was at Harvard and is still kicking around at MIT, as you might know. Claude Shannon, famous as the father of information theory. And the fourth guy was Nathaniel Rochester, who was the manager of information research at IBM at the time.
What were they there to talk about?
I can actually read a little bit of it. Their proposal said the study is to proceed on the basis of the conjecture that every aspect of learning or any other feature of intelligence can, in principle, be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it. Then they went on to say, we think that a significant advance can be made in one or more of these problems if a carefully selected group of scientists work on it together for a summer.
These men were not lacking in self-confidence, were they?
They were not. And after the conference, they made a number of wild predictions and got a great deal of publicity, which ruffled feathers at IBM Research. The sales force was visiting customers. They were reading about this, and they were getting worried.
What was IBM selling in 1956?
Data processing equipment. Really the only company, or the primary company, that was selling equipment of that kind. But the problem was that the customers were getting nervous about this stuff because they were concerned that these machines were somehow going to take over their own jobs. IBM decided in order to avoid this problem, they would close down their AI group, and then they armed their sales force with a response to this concern. And they came up with this little cliche that was, computers can only do what they are programmed to do. And that concept has set the tone, in my opinion, for the last 50 years of the way in which people tend to think of computers. And unfortunately, it's no longer true.
You also sort of hinted that it might be a threat, but I guess you're talking about to people's jobs, potentially, not to their actual lives or autonomy.
Well, the impacts on the job market are going to be extreme. There's a study that estimated that 47% of the U.S. working population, that their jobs will, in the next 5 to 10 years, come under potential threat of being completely automated. The people who are building these systems are going to have a unique advantage in terms of skimming off the increased economic value that they'll be providing to society. So it's going to have a significant impact, and already is having a significant impact, on income inequality.
So the alphas will get richer and richer, and the lower castes will just shuffle along with no purpose and not much money.
Both the upper and the lower castes. This is the peculiar thing about it. We're talking about lawyers and doctors, as well as the people who dig ditches and lay pipe. Really, we're going to find out that Karl Marx was right. The struggle between capital and labor is very real, but capital is going to win hands down.
So what's the distinction between strong AI and weak AI?
Strong AI is basically a concept that intelligence is some kind of magic pixie dust that you sprinkle on a machine, and it suddenly becomes conscious and aware. And that what we're trying to do in AI is to duplicate this magical quality. Now, weak AI is just a disparaging name for what we really see today, which is an engineering approach to artificial intelligence. It's solving specific problems that might be driving or playing chess. So strong AI is really for the sci-fi freaks, and weak AI is really for the engineers.
Let's talk about progress in weak AI. There's been a lot of it lately, right?
Absolutely. What's driving a revolution in artificial intelligence right now are really three fundamental things. Dramatic improvements in computing power and memory and networking. Just by way of example, the Watson program that won on Jeopardy, that had 4 terabytes of memory available to it to store all of its knowledge. If you look on Amazon today, you can buy 4 terabytes for $150. So we're talking about a speed of improvement that is utterly astonishing. The second thing really is breakthroughs in the research in what is commonly called machine learning. These are systems that learn by experience and learn by example, which leads me to the third point. What the internet provides is easy access to enormous mountains of data that can be used to train these systems. So the availability of that data has transformed artificial intelligence.
When we talk about training, we aren't really talking about just collecting more and more facts and information, right?
It really means exactly the same thing it means when you talk about, like, training your children. There's kind of objective written facts that one can study, and that's why they go to school. There's things that you tell them, informal knowledge about the way the world really works that's based on your own experience. That's commonly called culture, things that you pass on to your children. But the third is simply interacting with the world. So the way your autonomous car is going to learn about the way your driveway is shaped or whatever is by actually going out there and using sensory input in real time to incorporate that information into its model of the world. So all of those, the sensors, the internet, and access to the accumulated knowledge of mankind is going to make them incredibly smart.
I want to go back to your distinction between the engineers, who you approve of, and the science fiction freaks, like myself, of whom you don't. 6 years before the Dartmouth conference, Alan Turing, the famous British mathematician, designed his Turing test, which went like this. A human, who is designated as a judge, has a written conversation with a machine and another human for 5 minutes. Afterwards, if the human judge can't distinguish between his human correspondent and the machine one, the machine passes the test.
I think that the Turing test is really misunderstood. It wasn't really about some kind of bar exam for computers to be intelligent. If you actually go back and read what Turing had to say, he said, the original question, can machines think, I believe to be too meaningless to deserve discussion. Nevertheless, I believe that at the end of the century, the use of words and generally educated opinion will have altered so much that one will be able to speak of machines thinking without expecting to be contradicted. And he was right. I can say, oh, Siri's thinking about my question. And you're not confused about whether Siri is some kind of human-like intelligence. It's simply the use of the word.
But he believed the mind was essentially a meat computer, and so have many other people since then. Ray Kurzweil, the visionary that actually foresaw much of the internet, believes that he can reconstruct his father with enough data, and that if he can't tell the difference, then there is no difference.
Ray is a remarkable scientist, but my point of view, and I'm representing, I think, a certain class of people who believe this, I see very little evidence, none, that machines are going to become conscious. Let me quote a Dutch computer scientist who's quite famous, but most people have never heard of, Edsger Dijkstra. He put this really well in one sentence. The question of whether machines can think is about as relevant as the question of whether submarines can swim. The point is, they're going to do the same thing that you do, that you think of as thinking today, but they're not going to do it the same way, and it doesn't matter.
Perhaps it's doing something that looks a little like what we do, but isn't entirely like what we do. I mean, isn't thought about independent intention, not intention that is programmed in by somebody else? Or do you also think that that's just irrelevant, that individuality is one of those magical notions?
The notion of you as a unique individual will also apply to these machines because they are going to have their own experiences and they're going to draw their own conclusions and their own lessons from it. The real problem comes in if people are going to be attributing to these machines feelings and characteristics, which in my view, legitimately, they do not have. And those machines will be in a position to effectively manipulate us, acting in a way that evokes emotional reactions in us to providing sympathy for them.
What danger does it pose?
Well, it's that we include them in the circle of humanity and of mankind in a way where we sublimate our needs to the needs of these machines. And they will want to accomplish certain things. And if the best way to do that is to nag you or to cry at you or to put on a sad face, they might very well do that. They're going to be able to communicate with other machines, negotiate deals, offer arrangements, do things on your behalf. And that's going to create a variety of problems for society. And in particular, if we are not careful about the goals that we set and the capabilities that we provide these machines and these AI systems with, they have the potential to wreak havoc on our society.
I love talking to you, Jerry.
Oh, thank you so much, Brooke. It's a pleasure to talk to you, too.
I only have one final question.
Certainly.
Do you think if you scratch an engineer underneath, you find a science fiction freak?
I would love to give you a snappy answer, but I'll try it. I'm doing it right now, but I'm...
You have just outlined the plot of about 700,000 science fiction novels in warning, in a clear and dispassionate way, of the potential hazards of artificial intelligence.
You're absolutely right, and I come back to that IBM statement that computers can only do what they're programmed to do. That is completely false today. You know, I keep thinking of the example of squirrels crossing the road.
Mm-hmm.
Like, squirrels haven't evolved to deal with 2,000-pound piles of metal that approach them at 60 miles an hour, and that's why they get run over. You're not designed to deal with a threat that's diffuse in the cloud that is dealing with you in ways that you may not even realize. When you look at the two great scourges of the modern world, the first being rampant unemployment, and the second being income inequality, I think that a major cause of both of those is the accelerating progress in technology in general and in artificial intelligence in particular.
But you can't stop that.
No, you can't stop that, but there's a lot you can do about it. In other words, not to prevent it, but to make the transition to a new world much less bumpy. I think that Robot Armageddon is going to be economic, not a physical war.
Jerry, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Brooke.
Jerry Kaplan is an entrepreneur who teaches the history and philosophy of artificial intelligence at Stanford University. Earlier this month, there were reports of Google scooping up 8 robotic companies in a mere 6 months. Redwood Robotics specializes in arms, not weapons, arms. Industrial Perception focuses on 3D vision, and Mecha produces lovable humanoid heads. Since Google hasn't said much about why it bought these and the other companies, the media fill the void with nervous speculation. What might Google do with a robot army? Particular focus centered on Boston Dynamics, a company that's used military money to develop Big Dog, which hops and hums over rough terrain like a man-sized insect, Wildcat, that sprints like a metallic wolverine, Sandflea, which scuttles like a crab and leaps like a cat, and Atlas and Petman, who, believe me, you've already seen in your dreams. Henrik Christensen is a professor of robotics at Georgia Tech. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
This list of recent acquisitions covers AI, disaster relief robots, a four-legged robot that can run 30 miles an hour. Why?
Well, it really all boils down to competition on the market. Today, if you're trying to do product research, you will typically go to Amazon. Google is trying to get into logistics and material handling so that they can actually compete and make sure you go there to buy products rather than going to Amazon.
Right. We search Google for information. We search Amazon for stuff. It wants us to search Google for stuff.
Exactly. So, for instance, in San Francisco, there is something called Google Express, where the idea is that you can basically go to them and say, I want to buy a ring for my wife. And then they will actually send a driver to the store, buy the item, bring it to your spouse. And in the long term, now that we have autonomously driving cars, if we now use these smart robots, we would be able to pick these items up and actually deliver them. It's very much about getting you back to use Google, because a lot of their revenue is based on advertising. So if they know what you're looking for, they can make sure that they put the right ads in front of you.
All right, I could see how driverless cars might do that. But what do you need Big Dog and Wildcat and Cheetah for that are tested for rough terrain and the other ones that work through water? Is that so they don't have to use the highways?
If we think about it, to me, there are really 3 reasons why you do these acquisitions. One of them has to do with manufacturing. So can we automatically manufacture electronic goods, various kinds of assembly actions? 2, can we do the supply chain so we can drive it back and forth? And 3, today Google Maps are incredible. You can get Street View wherever you can drive a car. But you can't really get these very detailed Google Maps as soon as you go off-road. So being able to use Boston Dynamics and the other company that they bought, Shraft, gives them very agile robots and a high degree of autonomy that would allow you to build very detailed Google Maps of anywhere in the world. So you really have to look at it as the entire supply chain. How can you do better manufacturing? How can you do better deliveries? And how can you make sure that you have what we in technical terms would call a geographic information system? So now I can track you with my Android phone. I can know where were you last weekend. Based on this, I can have much more detailed information about what should I put up on your web page to make sure that you buy the right things.
Okay, so you're talking about robotic Henry Ford-type plants, robotic Pony Express, and potentially robotic Lewis and Clark.
Absolutely.
But The Guardian noted that Google has not only bought almost every machine learning robotics company it could find, it also hired Jeff Hinton, probably the world's leading expert on neural networks. And last year, it brought on the famed inventor and AI advocate Ray Kurzweil. Google, according to The Guardian, could embark on what one investor called a Manhattan Project of AI.
There's no doubt they've solidly bought many of the best brains to work in this area. As you mentioned, we have really good people on machine learning. We have fantastic perception people. We have really good robotics people. If you had to collect sort of the most impressive group of roboticists in the world, Google would have it today.
It strikes me that it's a natural development for the company that created an algorithm that can now provide you with searches by working off your previous searches, and even by understanding your misspellings, that develops translation technology also based on collecting data of people's mistakes and requests, that a company with that kind of expertise in software would move into robotics. Because, as one scientist said, robotics is different from software because it turns data into physical action automatically.
Exactly. That's the ultimate dream, you know. Can we build a very intelligent assistant that will work in your daily life? I think it's still a bit down the road. But if we interconnect the world, if you look at another company that Google has bought, they bought Nest. Some people call it the thermostat company. What it really is, they have a number of key technologies on interconnecting to your home. The thermostat is one. The fire alarm is another one. It can understand what is the air quality. But you can also imagine that it's connected up to your infrared detector that will detect if there are any people present and if they move around, so that the light turns on when you enter the room, and when you exit the room, it turns off again. If you fall down and you don't move for 30 minutes, it could signal to somebody that you might want to go and check on this person. So it's the ultimate service economy. You can tell me what services you want and we will deliver it to you. Of course, it will be at a cost.
Thank you so much, Professor.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Henrik Christensen is a professor of robotics at Georgia Tech. Coming up, bots that answer serious questions and tell stupid jokes. This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from GSK, whose Discovery Fast Track Challenge for Academics seeks to turn concepts into medicine at gsk.com/discoveryfasttrack. Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. And Road Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As Google buys up smart robots, some of which were developed with money from the military deploys AI to help fill its ranks. Right now I'm on the internet with an Army recruiter. I'm typing in, "Who are you?"
"My name is Sergeant Star, which stands for strong, trained, and ready. I'm an artificial intelligence agent created for the U.S. Army to provide you with information about Army life."
So how do we feel about Sergeant Star? Alex Goldman of our podcast TLDR wasn't sure, so he talked to the Army and other experts to consider the pros and cons of deploying a Siri to guide our decision to go to war.
Sergeant Star is the Army's robot. Specifically, he's a chatbot. But unlike some chatbots, he's got a face. If you go to the Army's website, you can see it. He's white, 30-something, and computer-generated. He straddles the uncanny valley between approachable and kind of vacant-looking. Like most chatbots, he's there to talk to you about one thing and one thing only. This chatbot wants to talk to you about your service in the U.S. Army. And he doesn't cotton too much to goofing around. Tell him to do some push-ups.
"Hey, I'm the sergeant here. You drop down and give me 20. I can't hear you. Count 'em."
I found out about Sergeant Star from Dave Moss. Dave's an investigative researcher with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and for him, Sergeant Star was just the latest bot he's formed a relationship with.
"I think the first bot I encountered was Eliza, and this was a very rudimentary bot that was supposed to function as a therapist. And I remember sitting in front of my computer at college, having these long conversations, trying to fool it, trying to get it to get angry at me. And it would just ask more questions. But there was something about engaging in the middle of the night with this character that fulfilled this, I don't know if it was a loneliness or if it was just a need for late night communication."
Even though he knew Eliza was a bot, she managed to simulate, to some degree, human contact, which is what made the idea of a recruitment bot a little creepy to him. So Dave got curious about how Sergeant Star works. But asking Sergeant Star about himself doesn't get you very far. He just pulls rank.
"Because I said so. And last I checked, I outrank you."
So, last November, Dave decided to FOIA the United States Army.
There were several things we asked for. One of the things primarily was the input and output scripts. These are all the things that Sergeant Starr can recognize and all the things that he can possibly say back to you. And we asked for that for every year he's been around so we could compare how he's expanded over the years and how his answers have changed. We also asked for guidelines for using him, privacy policies, how many people have used him, how many hours of manpower were saved.
Dave didn't get any response. Not even one saying they wouldn't release the information he requested. So I decided to just give them a call to see if they'd talk. Surprisingly, they were game. If the sound quality is a little funky here, it's because I spoke to a bunch of military officials and contractors who are all huddled over one speakerphone.
It's our pleasure. We're quite proud to talk about this innovative tool.
To answer some of Dave's questions, Sergeant Starr has a total of 840 answers he can currently give. His answers are analyzed every day, and they're adjusted every month. And the answers he gives change as military policy changes. Although the Army collects every question that's asked of Sergeant Starr, it doesn't collect any personal information of the askers themselves. The Army wasn't willing to divulge proprietary information about how Sergeant Starr works, but Colonel Keeter was otherwise pretty forthcoming.
Over the last 5 years, I believe the average is about 500,000 user engagements per year and about 2 million questions are answered. That's estimated to be an equivalent of 55 man years.
Cleek Grumley from NextIT, the company that programmed Sergeant Starr, told me that when the Army built him, it endlessly focus grouped him.
The Army was going to have several different avatars potentially. And then when they did focus group tests with people in a bunch of different, you know, ethnicities and age groups in different parts of the country, they all basically picked the same avatar. And so the Army elected to go ahead and just go with one. The current version is actually built off of a live soldier, and then it's rendered to make it look slightly animated.
Are there certain things that you didn't even know that recruits were interested in finding out until Sergeant Starr started getting those questions?
Yeah, the one that comes to mind is if you have to shower with other folks.
This was the most surprising thing to me about Sergeant Starr, that there were questions that potential recruits couldn't ask a recruiter but felt comfortable asking a chatbot.
Like, are there jobs where I wouldn't have to be deployed? Things about what they can bring to basic training, even down to they would ask Sergeant Starr questions about what toiletries should they bring.
There are questions a teenager might have about war that they're too scared to ask a person, but happy to ask a chatbot. Granted, Sergeant Starr is just the first step to recruitment, but as first steps go, it seems like a pretty good one. Still, I wanted to test my assumptions, so I got in touch with an expert.
Helen Benedict, professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and the author of Sand Queen and the Lonely Soldier, two books about the Iraq War.
In covering the Iraq War, Helen's heard stories of recruiters forging parental permission slips for underage recruits, lying to candidates about where they would end up, sexual assaults, and much more. In the early aughts, when Helen was reporting on this, the Army disclosed a, quote, 60% rise in inappropriate actions by recruiters. So when I asked Helen about the idea of Sergeant Starr, I figured she'd be on board. After all, a chatbot doesn't lie, and he doesn't pressure people to go to war so he can meet his quota.
It certainly takes away the power of an individual to manipulate a young recruit. But on the other hand, the choice to enlist is absolutely enormous, will change your life forever, if not, you know, end up getting you killed or maimed. And I think some communication with an honest human being is terribly important. The answers that this robot will give will be the official line. And the official line in the military, in my view, as a result of my research, is not always honest at all. Supposing you ask the robot, what are my chances of getting sexually assaulted as a female? Or, I'm gay and now don't ask, don't tell is over, but how is that going to actually affect me? I could predict that the answers will be the official line.
What are my chances of getting sexually assaulted in the military?
All soldiers are subject to the Uniformed Code of Military Justice and Army regulations which govern behavior and conduct. Commanders have a wide range of administrative and disciplinary measures to address substandard behavior and misconduct. Each case is addressed differently, depending on the circumstances.
Totally as I predicted.
Can you ask it about don't ask, don't tell and bullying?
I'm a gay man and I want to enlist as an openly gay man. What are my chances of being treated badly?
If otherwise qualified, individuals may join and serve in the Army without regard to sexual orientation.
That's it?
Listen, the truth of the matter is a live recruiter might well give you the same answers. I think there will be an honest recruiter who could tell you, look, you know, we do have a problem with sexual assault in the military, but we're really working on it, and here are some of the things you can do to protect yourself, and might actually get further with succeeding in recruiting someone.
It turns out that Sergeant Starr is a lot of different things. He's a robot who never sleeps. He's a person you can ask questions that you're scared to ask any other human being. He's also a rigidly bureaucratic pro-army voice that can give oblique answers to questions about your basic safety. He's frustratingly full of contradictions. And strangely, that makes him feel more human.
Thanks, I try.
OTM producer Alex Goldman is co-host of our podcast, TLDR. You can also find a blog post featuring all 835 of the answers Sergeant Starr gives on the Electronic Frontier Foundation's blog at eff.org/deeplinks. You can hear a longer version of this piece and a follow-up interview with David Moss at TLDR and onthemedia.org.
I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
As Sergeant Starr soldiers on, another bot is being tested to generate not grunts, but laughs. Decades of research has not yet yielded a machine capable of delivering a tight 10 minutes of observational humor, but computers can, under certain circumstances, grind out a joke. Recently, Joel Warner and Peter McGraw, authors of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny, pitted comedian Mike Kaplan against Manatee, a computer created to tell jokes. Joel Warner is going to see if I can tell which joke is human and which isn't.
Okay, you're going to guess now.
Okay.
I like thrills like I like flights. Cheap.
Cheap thrills, cheap flights. I think that since cheap in this context is being used as kind of salacious, sexy, that was the human, Mike.
You are incorrect.
Oh.
That was Manatee.
All right. Another?
I like fingers like I like my notes. Sticky.
That's the computer.
Yes.
Actually, artificial intelligence researchers have been studying computers and humor for a long time.
Yeah. Among my favorites would be LibJob, which is the light bulb joke generator, the double entendre noun transfer program, which figures out where inside passages of text to insert the line, that's what she said.
The current effort, the one that yielded Manatee, was a $700,000 government project?
Yes. Project received stimulus funding. And when Republicans heard that a joke computer received $700,000, they were fuming.
How can you justify that?
I think there's a valid reason. We spend so much time with our gizmos. We want the interactions to be as smooth and fluid as possible. In some ways, we want these things to almost be a bit human. I mean, who wouldn't want a GPS device that, after you ignore it for the 20th time, it somehow sarcastically rolls its eyes at you?
I would say almost everybody wouldn't want that. But I'm sure there's another example.
Well, think about when a web page doesn't load now.
Yeah.
Designers think we might be a little more okay with a stumble if a computer almost makes humor about it.
I guess if it were real, personifying a program can also run into a lot of problems. I mean, Clippy, may he rest in peace, was probably the most deeply unpopular thing ever produced by, what, Microsoft?
If Clippy made fun of himself, say, hey, I know you don't like me, but you pressed the wrong button, and here I am. I'm going to do my little Clippy dance. I mean, that might help make things a little more...
You are so right.
One of the examples of human intelligence is our ability to process all this information around us and find new and novel ways to make things funny. So it's actually a really good challenge, a really good goal.
Do humans really understand what makes things funny?
That's a very good question. There have been many attempts over the centuries to figure out what exactly makes things funny. You can go back to Plato and Aristotle, who said it was about superiority, laughing at the misfortune of other people. Then came the incongruity theory by folks like Kant, who said that humor arises when you're led to believe one thing and something else happens. Setups and punchlines work well. And then there was Freud, of course, who had his own theory.
Based on sexual frustration, no doubt.
Of course.
And do you have a favorite?
I have to say I'm partial to the one my co-author and I looked at in the book, The Humor Code. His name is Peter McGraw, and his theory is something called the benign violation theory. The idea that humor arises when something seems benign while simultaneously appears to be a violation or somehow wrong.
Of course, all of these can be right.
Yeah. There hasn't been enough hard and fast research to say this is it. This is the end-all be-all of humor research.
Okay. So a guy is going down the street, and he sees his friend. He hasn't seen him for I don't know how long. And he has this big orange head. And he goes up to him and he goes, "Hey, what's with the big orange head?" And he goes, "You know, it's a funny story. I was in an antique shop and I found this lamp and I rubbed it and a genie came out and gave me three wishes. And so I wish for a gorgeous house. And you see behind me this huge mansion? Yeah, it's really nice. That's the house. And then I wished for a beautiful wife. And you see that really lovely blonde coming down the street? That's my wife. And then here's where I think I went wrong. I wished for a big orange head."
The amount of kind of human intelligence that you and I have to one, tell that joke and create that joke and then appreciate it. I mean,
the smartest person I know did not get that joke.
I think it's less about pure intelligence, but I mean, how you process the world, how you see the world. I mean, how are you going to teach a computer to do that?
But if we were to do that, would that be the apotheosis of artificial intelligence?
Some people have suggested that one of the ultimate tests is to get a computer to tell jokes and appreciate jokes in all their forms. I think we're still a ways off on that.
What was the best joke told in the contest?
Oh, okay. I have to say the one that sums the whole contest up. I like jokes like I like robots. Efficient and killer.
And whose joke was that?
Thankfully for the human race. That was Mike Kaplan.
Joel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Joel Warner is the author of The Humor Code. Mike, that's M-Y-Q, Kaplan, is the comedian that competed with Manatee the computer. He was chosen in part for his, quote, robotic delivery.
Had some other jobs. I talked to a street musician once, found out that you can make up to $60 an hour being a street musician, or up to $60 a minute robbing a street musician. So...
It's hard, isn't it? Just standing there alone on the high wire.
I mean, it's a subjective thing. I'll do a show for military, and they'll come up after and say, "I could never do what you do." And I'm like, well, that's rude. You know, it's not... I could say the same. You know, like, worst case scenario for me is a room full of people doesn't like me. That's something I dealt with in high school every day.
Some say your comedy has been described as robotic, and your new album is called Meat Robot.
I definitely understand that. I like relationships and friendships, but I don't always necessarily outwardly manifest those emotions as much as other people do. So people like, for example, when I was married, I remember my wife would call me husbot. Now it's ex-husbot. Perfect.
Some comedians might have been afraid that they would lose to a robot.
I mean, comedy is subjective. There are, I'm sure, people who think that this robot is better than me. Either way, I was excited to be part of the story. If I win, then hooray for humanity. And if I lose, then we're the ones who made the computers. So it's still a win for humanity, at least.
So the structure of this was very simple.
Yes.
I like this like I like this.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a structure you'd used before?
It's sort of a comedy trope. The robot can find, oh, these two words mean the same thing, but in different situations, people might not have thought of that. So here is an incongruity. Is that a joke? That's my impression of the robot.
So how do you think the robot did at that?
I think it did great. I don't think they were the most sophisticated jokes of this type even, but I think they made sense. Most people are not the best when they start doing comedy, and I think this robot is off to a great start.
Let's grade some of Manatee's jokes.
Mm-hmm.
I like fingers like I like my notes. Sticky?
Yeah, that one, I guess, now thinking about it, that one could use some more work, I guess. Like, I like fingers didn't really... Oh, why do you like fingers? Like, nobody would ever say, I like fingers, unless there's some real specific great payoff of why they like fingers. But in that situation, it seems like it just thought, oh, it's seen the term sticky fingers and sticky notes. There's no real, like, you know, depth.
Resonance, yeah, there. Just about words. I like periods like I like my verbs. Irregular?
This robot is talking about a woman's cycle. That's if a robot were to perform, I think that would be the sort of the same way that, you know, Betty White, she's been funny for her whole life, but there's a specific thing that now is even, like, more incongruous about our idea of what an old person is supposed to talk about. It's like she doesn't even have to say a specifically funny thing, but people will think it's funny because it's an old person talking about sex.
Given the state of artificial intelligence these days, do you think this had any meaning? We can't really learn anything about humans by making a computer make a joke. It's still purely technical.
I guess the ideal is, like, I don't want, you know, robots taking my jobs, but as long as I keep working and as long as every other comedian can, like, maybe robots can be trained enough to, you know, go into hospital wards and, you know, the 23 hours a day that there's not a comedian there, they're like, what do you think about these jokes, robots? Or, like, you know, into an old folks home or, you know, doing a benefit for veterans. Literally, I have no idea what people are planning on doing with joke robots, if anything. So no greater meaning.
So what advice would you give Manatee?
Write and perform as much as possible, you know, figure out what works, bring it to the people. You've got a great avenue right now being the only joke robot, but I would say try to take a lower profile initially, just write a lot and then try things out on smaller crowds. Then I assume you'll get to a point where, you know, you might overtake me and I don't want that to happen. So I'd say, you know, just try to live a more fulfilling life, you know, become a service robot if you would. What do you want? What do you really want, Manatee?
Can I tell you this joke?
Of course.
Okay, you may have heard this before.
It's possible.
If you have, just stop me.
Sure.
Okay, so there's this guy, and he sees an old friend of his he hasn't seen for a long time, and he has a big orange head.
This is my favorite joke.
It's your favorite joke.
I love it so much.
Sometimes the smartest people just don't get it.
Do you want to hear my theory?
Yes.
If you heard for the first time, why did the chicken cross the road? You're expecting some grand answer, but the answer is to get to the other side. You know, the expectation is it's something, so the dashing of that expectation is that it's nothing, which is the same thing here. You probably had heard so many jokes about genies where people wish for something and it goes slightly awry. I didn't say a 12-inch pianist, you know? I didn't say a million ducks. Mm-hmm. You know, your brain has become practiced in the art of understanding that that's what's going on here. These other people who don't get it, they're just people who, I guess, led lives full of not enough jokes.
It's so funny because the big orange head joke is my favorite joke, too.
It's wonderful.
I always thought it was because the answer is that human beings just do stupid things. Just really idiotic choices.
I mean, your interpretation is by no means incorrect.
Mm-hmm. But it's true that in the moment, which is where you live as a comedian, it would be, well, we all know, you know, the genie trope.
Yes. You bring this greater human meaning to it, but I don't think anyone could not have heard any jokes like them and still feel that exact same way about it. So it's certainly not the only thing at play, but it's definitely a portion of it.
I have this brilliant friend. I think you're right. A, she doesn't have enough jokes in her life, even though she laughs a lot, but not at jokes. And B, I don't think that she immediately goes to the place that human beings just make completely illogical choices.
So you say, well, wish for a big orange head. And she's like, well, why would he do that? That doesn't seem like the thing to do. What's the rest of the joke?
Thank you so much, Mike.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
On May 15th, Mike Kaplan's comedy special comes out on Netflix. It's called Small, Dark, and Handsome.
Robots need love too. They want to be loved by you.
We anthropomorphize, experts say, because it's the way we create order in a complex world. We see faces everywhere, in a slab of rock, the grill of a car. Though computer intelligence is seductive, it's just as inhuman, answerable only to human overseers too remote to see its impact on the rest of our species. So go ahead and project humanity onto the howl of the wind. But if you sense it in your operating system, unplug and take a shower. They want to be loved by you. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdorahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Leslie Sisson. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.